All right, I think that is everyone. I think we're missing one more speaker, but probably will hop in and join us in the next few minutes. Can everyone hear me okay? Just want to get a quick mic check before I go off into the intros. All right, awesome. Thanks, Tor. Awesome. Thank you, everyone, for joining the event this evening. We're going to be talking on the Universal Privacy Alliance's upcoming Privacy Summit at ETH Denver, and then also going into a deeper discussion around different privacy narratives and different approaches to Web3 privacy that hopefully everyone in the audience can take something away and enjoy as well. So I want to apologize first for the issues with the Twitter Spaces link. Don't really know what happened. Tried to start the other link and had a lot of errors and different issues. So we had to opt into this new one. So that is the reason we had a little bit of a change there. But I want to start off this event by allowing just all the different speakers to give a chance to introduce themselves. I see we have four of the five currently up here, and obviously we've got one more dropping in. So when that fifth person comes in, we'll allow them to introduce themselves as well. So I guess to kick this off, I'm going to pass it over to our representative from Mobilecoin to give a quick intro, and then we can go from there.
Hey everyone, my name is Ko, Strategic Operations Lead at Mobilecoin. Thanks for having us. Excited to talk about this Twitter space.
Awesome. Thanks, Ko. And then, yeah, kick it over to you, Josh. Josh, I see you're up here from ECC.
Hey, thanks, Ian. Hi, everybody. Yeah, I'm Josh Swihart. I'm a Senior Vice President of Growth at Electric Coin Company, and we built and are now one of the supporters of Zcash.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. And obviously, my name's Ian. I am obviously with ECC as well, working on Zcash. And then we've got someone from Secret Network and Secret Foundation. Tor, allow you to introduce yourself.
Hey everybody, this is Tor from Secret Foundation. We're also one of the many entities supporting the Secret Network ecosystem. So happy to be representing not just Secret, but just the greater cause of Web3 privacy today.
Awesome. Thanks for the color there, Tor. And then passing it over to Will. Last of our speakers up here.
Hi everybody, I'm Will. I'm Ecosystem Growth Manager at the Oasis Protocol Foundation. And yeah, just thank you so much for having us. And I'm excited to talk about, privacy and confidential compute and everything that it enables in Web3.
Awesome. Well, thanks for all the intros there, guys. I'm excited to dive into this conversation. I think, we've obviously got someone else from Aztec Network who's going to be joining the space as well. So when I see that invitation, I'll add them up here to this call as well. So, but to get started, we're going to ETH Denver, going to be there very shortly. And something that we're all very interested in is this privacy summit that's being hosted by the Universal Privacy Alliance. And something that we want to talk about is why we're differentiating Web3 privacy or something. Why do we need to even have, a specific summit around the privacy narrative, and why does that even exist? So I want to kick it off to Josh. I want you to allow, what's the inspiration of the UPA, and what's the reason why are we having this privacy summit in ETH Denver?
Sure. So the UPA, actually, I think originally it was kind of maybe the brainchild of Harry Halpin at NIM. And the idea, some things that happened this last year, certainly highly concerning, as it relates to actions related to sort of cash and OFAC. And there's kind of recognition that there's a lot of us that are working on privacy related issues across crypto and working on privacy projects, and but we weren't well coordinated, and so we were most of us kind of working in our own silos, doing some great work and some effective work, both in terms of technology as well as kind of regulatory and policy work. But the issue is like much bigger than any one project, and so our intent was to come together, and to start to build much more of a kind of a cross ecosystem force for good, so that we ultimately can, kind of protect, not only protect but advocate for, our human rights and the needs for privacy and the various issues, and to be able to provide these different perspectives that we all have in the ecosystem, kind of as a unified front. So we've come together on a number of events, and this next one being in Denver, I think it's going to be great. I think we have I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 times the number of people registered than we can actually support at the event. And so there's a lot of interest. And so that's great. So we look forward to seeing folks there.
No, yeah, I think that's a really great overview. And I think something I want to post to the group right now is there's this idea and this term that's been labeled as Web3. A lot of us use it, a lot of different people in the ecosystem working on privacy-centric applications or not are using it as to describe this new version of the internet where more people can have more ownership over their financial transactions, their data, and then the way they interact with certain applications. So I want to pose something to the group here. Can Web3 or this idea of Web3 even exist without privacy? And I think that can be a great way to start this conversation and then, yeah, dive into more of how to make the privacy narrative just as normal as the standard cryptocurrency or crypto economy narratives. So I want to pose that to the group really quickly.
I'm happy to answer the supposedly question. I mean, it's pretty rhetorical asking this group, right? I mean, the answer for me is clearly no, or at least what I would interpret to be the vision of Web3, what we promise users in Web3, if we want to keep that brand promise, so to speak, and then we're saying, actually, we don't have any privacy, you break that promise immediately to the user. We're telling them that it's going to be this more empowering digital economy, whether you're transacting and it's about financial privacy, or whether you are a creator or a collector, you're more on that sort of media focused side of the space that's been emerging with NFTs and this cultural aspect. All of these applications immediately break their promise to the Web3 user if they don't have privacy. We're telling them that it's more empowering, it's more sustainable. This is somehow better than the centralized systems because it's more user-centric. But as soon as they're forced into interacting in these radically transparent systems, the promise is already broken. They don't have the protections that they think they would have if we were really keeping that promise to the user. In fact, in most ways, it's worse than the Web2 world. At least in the Web2 world, you have to wait for somebody to leak the Equifax database or something for your privacy to be exploited, or you have to wait for the data to be sold to Cambridge Analytica. The way that most of Web3 works now is it's on public by default blockchains that reveal everything to every user and every observer of the chain. So the quick answer for me is no, it can't exist the way that we sell it to users unless we build privacy. It can exist without privacy, but that's more of like a nightmarish dystopia than an actual empowering economy that we've been pitching it as.
Yeah, I would like to follow up with Tor. I think that like he hit the nail on the head. To me, it's all about, I guess, like, what is the promise of Web3? The promise of Web3 is that it'll be a more decentralized and user-owned, self-custodied version of Web2. And so what we need to do in Web3 is we have to enable our applications and our use cases to have the same user experiences and the same level of sophistication of the applications that exist in Web2 today. And like right now, that's just not the case. You know, privacy is fundamental to in almost every aspect of Web2. So we're like, you know, the ability to have like at least private from the general public type of, you know, use cases. So e-commerce, like people can't see what you're buying with your credit card. Supply chain, you know, when you're putting those invoices in, like your competitors can't see what you're doing. Even like, you know, social media, things like that, like you have the ability to block people and hide, you know, what your content is and what your posts are and stuff like that. And sort of like none of this is really possible in Web3 today, or it's not at the same level of sophistication and the same level of user experience as what exists in Web2 today. And that's what I think, you know, privacy and confidential compute really offer the space. It enables the ability for us to really compete with like the Web2 world on an even playing field where we can offer the same experiences.
I think that's a really interesting point, because I just want to say one thing. Like, there was something that dropped today. I think a platform that enables you to look up a user's, you know, DeFi or financial transaction data via various blockchains, and you can just do it by looking up their like Twitter username, right? Like, I think it's super crazy that it's getting to the point where you just have to type in, like, for example, me, you can type in my Twitter username and you can see every transaction that I've ever done on Ethereum. And I think that's wild. Like, Josh, I think I cut you off there. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to try to define terms a little bit. Because when we talk, and maybe everybody's familiar, so forgive me, but just to go back to kind of the basics. So Because I think even the definition of Web3 is argued by some. Some think it's just a kind of a crypto buzzword. But I don't think it is, right? So I was a user of Web1. And, with Web1, the idea, right, is that you could create a web page with content and have somebody come and view that content and engage that way. But it wasn't interactive. And so Web2 was interactive and allowed these very kind of rich applications and ecosystems to exist where users could create content and participate. But the only way to do that was through these kind of centralized entities. So centralized entities like Twitter or Facebook or MySpace back in the day or whatever. And the incentives were misaligned. So users didn't want to necessarily have to pay a fee to participate in those spaces. And so those spaces made use of everybody's data. And so they stored that data, they watched that data, they brokered it, made APIs so third parties could mine that data. And what had happened is that all happened without users' consent. So we didn't know, and we don't know with Web2, who has access to our data, what they're doing with it, how are they using it. You know, some of these leaks kind of come out and it's very disturbing. But that's the problem. So we have this kind of opportunity to rebuild the web with Web3, where the incentives become aligned, where as a user, I can determine, I can't be censored, I can participate without that entity determining that I can have a user ID or not. I can determine what I want to share and what I want to keep to myself or private, or what I want to disclose, to the rest of the world through these systems. And we have these kind of token mechanisms that allow for some of this incentive alignment, but it's completely antithetical to think that, that you can have a completely open system, and allow users to consent, right? The consent has to come from the, kind of the other direction, that we can now choose to disclose what we want to disclose. But by default, the stuff is private and I'm not disclosing any more than I want, because then once that's disclosed, I'm making that decision, then third parties have the ability to, use that, whatever I've disclosed, in kind of whatever marketing tactics or in order to manipulate, and surveil or for whatever reason. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of set the framework for what is Web3 and why privacy has to be, I think, to Tor's point, has to be part of it. It doesn't make sense without it.
So I want to piggyback off something you just said there, Josh, and I want to, open it up to the broader group. The word disclose, right? Giving the user the option to disclose certain information to certain parties in the way that they choose. From a privacy protecting standpoint and protecting user data and just protecting users in general, is it more of an effort from a product side? Do we just need to build better products that give users that optionality and are really easy to, understand user interface, or, the products very clearly educate users on the risks associated with them? Or is it more of a narrative, play here? Are we trying to just really reinforce the narrative that this is an opportunity for people to gain their privacy back? Or is it, do we need to build better products than the transparent alternatives that currently exist in the space? I want to open up that conversation and kind of see what everyone's feeling there.
Yeah. So, in my opinion, I think that, it's sort of both, and it's sort of about timing. So the first step right now, and I think some of the things that all of our products, all of our respective projects have been working on is building the better tooling, the better products to enable these things. And once the products get to the point where, they're easy to use, the value can be seen, and we can start integrating them into ecosystems, then it becomes, that's the timing for the narrative. The narrative almost, it's valuable to begin speaking about the narrative early, but at the same time, until there's a way to actually, be, to for users to disclose and to grant and revoke permissions and to access data and these sorts of things, until that becomes like easy to use and integrated into the broader Web3 ecosystem, like it sort of falls on deaf ears because you're ringing the bell about privacy and responsible data, but there's no real way for people to get involved before that. There's no real way for people to get involved. And so I think that that's, you know, we're coming up to that pivot point where the technology has now caught up and now it becomes like time for us to really begin spreading the narrative, explaining, evangelizing, I guess, the use cases for privacy and why people should respect their own data and respect their own privacy when they're interacting with these applications and to seek out alternatives to transparent applications in favor of ones that, you know, preserve their privacy.
When we think about applications in the Web3 space, I kind of bucket them into two major categories. We've got the ones where it's like, this is really only for the power users, the crypto natives, people who are deeply experienced with wallets, really understand all the UX challenges of today. You know, they're still impacted by it, but they're willing to tolerate it. And then there's everybody else, the newer users, people who are crypto curious, but have a lot more comfort with, say, centralized exchanges than they do trying to interact with a DeFi protocol. And what happens when we try to scale Web3 applications is, just like Web2 applications, most of the ones that are focused on that long tail of retail users, people who we're really trying to empower through these applications, right? The people we're supposed to be building these for, just like Web2 products, you need to create a critical mass of those users. You need to be building a marketplace that serves both sides of the marketplace. And for that, you need a lot of people to come. Or you need a successful DeFi protocol with a lot of liquidity. For that, you need a lot of people to come. The challenge I've seen with privacy, like even though the tech's been there, right? We've had privacy-preserving smart contracts live on mainnet on Secret since 2020. The challenge hasn't been just building the privacy tech. It's how do you create these application ecosystems that are not only privacy preserving, but interoperable enough that you can get people into and out of the ecosystem, and, you know, applications that are compelling enough for people to want to discover them, to give up not only other Web3 applications like they're sick of ETH DeFi, but to give up Web2 applications like they're sick of Twitter and they want to try this decentralized alternative. Every time you create a new hurdle like that, it's a substantial hurdle. You have to have an incredible UX, incredible emotional experience, an incredible value proposition. It's not just that, you know, eventually privacy is just going to be table stakes. But for right now, it's not really enough of a differentiator to get people into these platforms. The moment where we reach that inflection point is going to be when we successfully build privacy-preserving applications in Web3 that are also best in class in their category, beyond privacy, but just the best DeFi protocol, the best NFT marketplace, whatever leverages privacy to benefit the end user. But maybe privacy itself isn't the end value proposition. It is just the means to the end, which is empowerment.
Ian, can you just restate your question? I don't know if I fully understood it.
Yeah, so I think I'm just kind of going off what Tor said, right? It's like, is getting people into the private aspect or privacy-centric side of Web3 in this moment in time, is it building better products? Or are we trying to, you know, evangelize them to get them ready for this future state where the products might be ready? Like, how do you feel about the balance between creating better products than transparent alternatives and also winning like this communications / marketing battle and ensuring users really know the trade-offs that they're making when they're using a transparent app, you know, transparent application versus one that protects their user privacy?
Got it. I mean, I think, you know, you have to create a product where the customer or the user can very explicitly feel and appreciate the value, whether that's privacy or something else. And kind of to both what Will and Tor have mentioned is that right now, most of these products, I mean, there's very few people that even use crypto, period. And the Venn diagram of people who care about crypto and then privacy is even smaller because there's just not a lot of use cases for them. So I think if you want people to really understand and appreciate why they should care about privacy preserving protocols, they need to feel like, again, they're getting a benefit to use those privacy preserving protocols without being severely inconvenienced.
I would add at Aztec, our perspective very much is that privacy has to have value all the way down on the contract layer. Developers have to see it as a valuable technology to integrate into their application, and needs to kind of like expand the feature set of things that can be built on blockchains. And so I've long held the perspective that if we're convincing people to adopt privacy solutions 5 years from now, then we've kind of lost, because I think there are two elements of it. There's privacy as ideology, which is really hard to sell, right? You know, we're all hardcore privacy advocates here, but I think I would claim that that's the minority of human beings in the world. And to Ko's point, you know, that's we can't expect that audience to just naturally grow. And so I think about what can privacy enable when you have private variables or private functions or private contracts or private accounts. And kind of like Ethereum introduced this idea of contract composability, this notion of being able to modify a private state is itself an incredibly powerful kind of even game mechanics primitive that we expect developers will be able to run with. And, you know, kind of to some of this other speaker's points here, privacy as a right kind of gets carried along with that increase in feature set.
But I want to disagree just a little bit. Not that that should be baked into those things, but kind of this notion that people don't care, or that we're in the minority. We have an expectation when you use your browser, right, that when by default we're using HTTPS, that people aren't able to sniff the network and see our transactions. We have an expectation that when we open a bank account, that information is going to be available for everybody to see. We even have it, we're developing an expectation, and it's even codified in some laws, that if we give somebody access to our data, it may only be for a short period of time. And we may choose to go back to that site and request that they remove that data. We see that in, you know, codified in things like GDPR in the EU and in California here in the US. So I think it's right, like as everybody has talked about, that it like natively has to be very simple in order for people to kind of want to use it by default, but especially in financial transactions, in order for this to go mainstream, there has to be a feeling of security and safety that my financial data isn't out there for everybody to see for all time.
I would generally agree with that. You know, since no one else chiming up, I think most people, it's not that maybe they don't care, they lack the knowledge or awareness to care, right? They don't know what they don't know. And so if they were maybe perhaps more educated of some of the vulnerabilities that they're kind of suffering from fully transparent systems, then they probably would care, to your point, right? I think, you know, MobileCoin, we're focused on payments. That's kind of our North Star, just fast, private, and mobile compatible payments. And I think it's pretty easy for your average person to understand, like, yeah, I don't want everyone in the world to know or to be able to read my bank statement every time I buy a cup of coffee at a Starbucks. I don't think anyone necessarily would disagree strongly with kind of that mentality, but they don't necessarily realize, I think most people don't realize that that is how most of these public transparent blockchains work today. And then also to my earlier point is that most people do not follow crypto, period, right? We're like, in most people don't care about crypto at all.
Yeah. I mean, they do pick up the newspaper, though. So when they pick up the newspaper, they're not really like the privacy issues with blockchain aren't front page news. You know, FTX getting nuked is front page news. Terra blowing up is front page news. That's what sort of reinforces the idea for people that crypto is actually a speculator's paradise. It's not the rails of some new world economy. And so when they do finally start to grasp some of the core tenets of crypto, and they want to explore the products that maybe are closer to what crypto was supposed to be, not what it became in the public consciousness, not like the arena sponsorships and such, the problem there is a lot of them are also getting a lot of messaging from the media that is negative about privacy. The idea that privacy is what enables terrorism or enables North Korea to do all these things. A lot of our work has been to reframe it to say, well, the fact that so much of this is happening on completely radically transparent public blockchains is what allows an actor like North Korea to come in and try to exploit these systems. We've created these gigantic honeypots in Web 3 that are potentially even larger than the ones in Web 2 or have fewer protections and controls. So when people hear about privacy in Web 3, this happens all the time. They're always saying, it's like, well, I don't think we want privacy for cryptocurrency. That's just going to be all kinds of money laundering. If someone's coming in with a negative interpretation of what we tried to build, it's a two-step process. First, you have to convince them the negative is not true. Then you have to convince them of the positive benefits. It would be nice if more people were coming in with a completely neutral beginner's mindset to the idea of privacy in Web3, but I do think a lot of people, unfortunately, have been primed to be skeptics of privacy for finances in general because of that narrative. And that's really just unfortunate. And it takes something like the UPA and all of us working together to push back against that narrative so that at least people are coming in, if not with a fully positive view of what we're trying to do, at least without having been compromised by this idea that privacy is bad or negative and not a fundamental human right.
So I'm trying to, like, as the moderator here, I'm also in this place of like trying to learn and understand the different things that you guys are bringing up and the different points that you guys have all made. And there's two things I've heard so far. Like, there's this narrative battle that people are, you know, they're coming into the space, they hear all these bad things about crypto if they're outside the space. And then when they're coming in, they're already skeptical about privacy due to the negative narratives around it, right? And then there's this other side that deals with like, oh, we need to build these applications that make it, you know, just as seamless, and if not more than, you know, using the transparent alternatives that exist today, and even the Web2 alternatives, for example, like the social media one was really good. How can we create a decentralized social networking platform that's going to take users away from Twitter and into a new environment? So I think the thing I'm trying to understand right now is there's different ecosystems like aligned, right? So you have Ethereum, for example. Zcash is like a standalone, like layer one blockchain with some integrations, but very much focused on like payments. And then you have Aztec, you know, rolling up to Ethereum, and then obviously Secret Network, part of the Cosmos ecosystem. How do you guys all think about aligning with certain ecosystems and those different advantages that come from that in helping forward the mission of Web3 privacy? Do we need to break down the entire infrastructure as it stands today and start from scratch? Or is there ways that we can improve the current ecosystem and allow privacy to become more of a centric part? I just want to gather everyone's thoughts on that, because that's something I'm curious about as I'm listening to this conversation.
I can jump in. I'll make it really quick, right? Like, we have a very simple thesis as being part of the Cosmos. We just believe in a multi-chain future. So we built Secret to be standalone. It can be its own L1 fully private stack that you can build on as a developer. So you can build a private by default application on Secret and have those privacy guarantees without interacting with any other universe. Because whenever you go over a bridge to a public by default universe in Web3, something is getting leaked. Some aspect of privacy is being compromised, and maybe that's not acceptable to a user or a developer. But we believe in a multi-chain future. We believe all these networks are going to want to talk to each other. Users are going to want assets they own on one chain to be available on another. And so therefore, we've also built these privacy as a service capabilities where you can use Secret contracts in multi-chain applications. You just use a privacy preserving contract on Secret, let's say for randomness, or to provide some sort of walletless experience for an end user, or access control mechanisms for an application in healthcare. All of these things are possible with the architecture that we've chosen, but that architecture doesn't silo us. We deliberately chose to build in the Cosmos because we wanted to interoperate with all of the networks here, and especially we wanted to interoperate with other privacy-first ecosystems, because when you go privacy to privacy instead of privacy to public and you make that bridge, now you really are protecting users end to end, even as you move from one network to another. We would love to see more people building privacy first, because it gives us places to bridge to and to interoperate with where we can keep the promise to the user, even as they move assets in and out of Secret.
Yeah, I would say like from the Oasis perspective, we have a very similar, you know, thought process to scaling privacy to Web3 as a secret, as well as a similar sort of architecture in that regard. So we recently launched the Sapphire paradigm on Oasis, which is, you know, enables, you know, privacy first native applications to be built. But sort of our thought process is that in order to like really move the needle on privacy and confidential computation, it sort of has to be like a little by little process. And so we also have adopted an approach that's like cross-chain, where you can just offload, you know, essentially applications from any network can offload their confidential compute needs to Sapphire. So what does that look like? That looks like, you know, instead of having a completely transparent governance proposal for a DAO, you can do just, you know, use Sapphire just to have the confidential voting, but you can still keep your entire DAO on Ethereum or Polygon or BNB if that's where you so choose. So like add a little bit of privacy, a little bit of confidential computation to start getting people aware of, you know, what the limitations of 100% transparent blockchains are, and to start, you know, thinking about these aspects of privacy and where they can fit into their applications. You know, another one is like gaming. So if you have like an RPG game on Polygon or BNB, and like 90% of the game doesn't need any sort of privacy or confidential computation, then like that's okay. But what happens when you need to create a puzzle or a riddle, you know, where the solution needs to remain hidden so that, you know, the game is not broken? You know, you can put just that puzzle or riddle on Sapphire, and then, you know, send encrypted transactions to signal your answer to the riddle. And then, you know, if you get that answer correct, a message can go over a messaging bridge where you get your NFT reward or your XP reward or whatever on the home chain or the origin chain. And so I think that like this is our approach to privacy and confidential computation, is to just do it little by little, because once people see the value in that, then they'll start seeing the value in all these other aspects of privacy. But sort of you have to get the ball rolling with small things first, provide value, and then get people thinking about where else they can provide value.
You know, we've approached this from kind of a couple different stances, right? We're, like I said, focused on payments and solving some of the issues that come from the transparent systems and from the legacy systems. And so from the protocol side, we've built and by we, I mean the team of amazing engineers here at MobileCoin, have built a blockchain that is fast, private, scales on mobile, and very, very low transaction fees. On the application side, we've built a first-party non-custodial wallet, and that has been an effort led by one of my colleagues, who's the chief product officer at MobileCoin, named Bob Lee. And he was the first CTO of Square, and then he created Cash App. And we've been very focused on building a product that is on par with the standard or the current standards of the Web2 experience, or if not, you know, exceeds them. It has to be, again, non-custodial and also private by design, because since we're focused on solving payments, to all the reasons we've already kind of discussed earlier, ultimately, all things being equal, we think that customers and users are going to prefer those products. And that is, again, kind of been our approach. We're just trying to build products that solve real-world use cases. And Bob was limited when he was creating Cash App in that, you know, Cash App only functions in the U.S., and on top of that, users don't really own and custody their funds. And so with Mobi, you know, and MobileCoin, you can send US dollars anywhere in the world at a very low scale. And part of the design that I've been kind of critical of Web3 is, you know, something like, it's a horrible user experience if you want to send a dollar to someone, a dollar of USDC, but then you need a native token from, you know, some other blockchain like ETH. In my opinion, I think your average consumer is going to have a very difficult time adopting to that mechanism for payments, because it's just a lot of friction. It has to be as easy and fast as a Venmo, Cash App, or, you know, swiping a credit card or paying someone in dollar bills. And so those are kind of been, those have been our North Stars as far as how we approach building these products.
I think to the original question, Aztec is built on Ethereum because we think Ethereum has done a lot of the hard work of becoming a highly reliable and universally secure settlement layer. But that doesn't mean we don't believe in multi-chain. Our ZK programming language, Noir, creates a Solidity verifier that can be deployed to any EVM chain. And so you can harness the power of zero knowledge, regardless of what chain you want to settle on, so long as it's EVM compatible. And that allows you to prove arbitrary private computation. And so you can create off-chain games, off-chain DAO voting, lots of private encrypted infrastructure, which is compatible with other chains as well. And the long-term goal here is for all those smart contracts eventually to be deployed to Aztec Network's encrypted blockchain. But that doesn't mean we don't want to support the zero-knowledge community writ large and make sure that every chain has access to private compute.
And I just likewise also, we're, as to the kind of the portion of the ecosystem, how we look at that, we're very much, you know, we recently partnered with Reserve Protocol, and we're very much in alignment with what a lot of the other Web3 protocols and projects are doing. And the way we've approached some of this kind of collaborative effort is working with other bridging solutions and trying to be able to offer some of the attributes on our chain to other assets and vice versa. We leverage some of the attributes of these other native chains to scale MobileCoin and USD.
Yeah, I want to piggyback on the MobileCoin example here. Like, I think everyone like who has this opportunity to experience this, like, you should definitely try and send U.S. dollars to another part of the world and kind of go through that process of having to deal with like the different applications, because it's something I'm actually experiencing right now, and it is a bit of a headache. So having like a system that can be borderless and global and allow for just as fast transactions as I might experience with like Venmo in the United States, like, I think that's like a huge, you know, really cool use case that I think can be underappreciated. And I wanted to give, you know, you a shout out there, because I, you know, bringing up that importance is something I'm currently experiencing in my day to day. But I want to shift, because, you know, we've covered a lot here. So we've covered, you know, building different products and users will come once the products exist. We've talked a little bit about narratives. We've talked about ecosystem alignment. I think like a question that kind of came to me after I was listening to all this, like, what are some of the applications that you think need to be built that can bring in like the next wave of adoption for crypto-centric applications, Web3, whatever kind of nomenclature you want to put behind it? What are your guys' thoughts on that? Like, different applications that we need to build. I know MobileCoin, you were just mentioning like the payment side of it, but what are some applications potentially beyond that? Like, what are things that, you know, new users might be really interested in that will cause them to come in and adopt these like Web3 centric products? Do you guys have any ideas? Is there something you guys are currently building? You know, what's the general consensus there?
Go for it, man. I went first.
Oh, yeah, no worries. Thanks, Tor. So I think like one that it's not necessarily an application specifically, but more so tooling that enables a lot of applications would be something like decentralized identity, which obviously goes back to privacy. But the ability to have, you know, your personal data connected to a wallet address or something like that in a privacy preserving way, which then can, you know, enable more sophisticated applications. You know, having credit scores associated with your wallet can enable like under-collateralized lending or something along those lines. But it doesn't have to be just, you know, financial. It can be, you know, social media as well. You know, it can be something like connecting your Discord to your Twitter account and connecting that to your wallet, but doing it in a way so that like no one can make that. I think someone brought up earlier that someone, you know, made a an algorithm or something that can just, you know, pull up people's financial transactions on blockchains by just searching their Twitter addresses. That's what we're trying to avoid. And so I think with something like a decentralized identity, you know, better than, maybe not better than some of the solutions, but more comprehensive than the solutions that exist today, we can start enabling a suite of new applications that'll just go back to making, you know, Web3 more sophisticated and have better user experiences. So that would be like my major ask in the next few years.
Identity and reputation comes up all the time when we talk about privacy. And again, it's just about how many things are going to integrate with these things. How interoperable is that global reputation going to be for users? Where we've seen the most adoption from users when it comes to things associated with identity, I think, has been with NFTs and digital collectibles. And that's where users are already telling us we want to own some things that we really own because we have the keys to the wallet. So we really have these things. And as we've built out more NFT-focused applications that are privacy first, we've realized that that's serving a lot of needs for users, both collectors and creators, that weren't served already by like the public by default NFTs. A lot of those public by default NFT ecosystems are really not that interesting or kind of lame for users, don't protect creators, don't form real connections between collectors and creators. And it's where users are already adopting Web3 technology and saying, we prefer this in a lot of ways to Web2 technology. So where privacy comes in there, it's been really additive and it's created some very unique experiences. We've seen a lot of adoption, for example, of secret NFTs, privacy first NFTs in our ecosystem. We've seen a lot of different projects building with secret NFTs, including Stash, including Legend DAO, including Ekati. There's a number of other projects I could name in our ecosystem that have all already started building with secret NFTs for that reason, because you can get these ideas of privacy preserving ownership, privacy preserving traits and metadata so that only the owner has access to that information. That's a much narrower go-to-market, but it is potentially a much more plausible immediate go-to-market for the kind of tech that we're building here. When people can get hands-on with it, it'll happen a lot sooner than we see this kind of privacy preserving tech being integrated, let's say, with a central bank digital currency, most likely. But at least it proves that there's user demand for this, that they're going to prefer to use applications that have these privacy guarantees. And that is a massive battle to win on its own. So I hope that people here are not just thinking about, you know, what we're trying to grab for at the end of this process, but what are all the baby steps along the way where we can prove that there's demand for privacy in the Web3 space. And that demand is how we prove that there's going to be a future for the even more complex identity and reputation-based use cases that are privacy-preserving.
By the way, this is a little bit of a tangent, but you had mentioned CBDCs and talking about identity. It was actually encouraging. Today was kind of an encouraging day on that front here in the U.S. We'll see what happens. Majority Whip Tom Emmer posted out a proposal that would stop the Fed from issuing a retail CDBC, and specifically talking about the dangers of financial privacy and government surveillance and overreach. And so I think there is, and I think it was like maybe, I think the bill is co-sponsored by maybe up to like a dozen other congressmen, congresspeople. And so I think, you know, maybe knock on wood, some of that tide is changing a little bit as it relates to the expectation of privacy and recognizing the dangers, even in the case of, you know, I know, you know, many in the US government believe, many regulators, many policymakers believe users should have privacy. It's necessary for, you know, privacy is necessary for Web3. It's necessary for this whole world to work in order to provide user security and business security, national security, except from the government where they want access. And so it's nice to actually see some leadership from policymakers on kind of recognizing the potential for great harm if with something like a retail CDBC that allows for government tracking and tracing. So I have some hope that we're moving in the right direction in some circles. So a little bit of a tangent, but some positive news today.
Yeah, that's totally huge. I kind of think about privacy less as enabling a singular killer use case and more about kind of how the stack of composability changes relative to core Ethereum in our case, as the most relevant comparison. If you think about like a composable, private, you know, ZK proof driven set of economic activities, you can imagine if you're an individual, you get compensated by your company privately. So nobody can see your income, which is very important for business competitiveness as well as individual discretion. And then you use, let's say, your streaming income to back a loan, an under-collateralized loan that's based on the expectation that you'll be paid by your employer, which is the way that under-collateralized lending works out in the real world. And you furnish a piece of decentralized and private on-chain credit as an attestation to be like, I'm good for this, I'm going to pay you back. And that credit score is proven to be above the threshold necessary for you to receive the loan. And so you can kind of see where I'm going, where, you know, the starting privacy, building privacy into the base layer allows for these, an entire stack of games of confidentiality and anonymity that make it possible for us to actually have a more real world like economy that we're not really able to do these days.
Yeah, that seems to be, I would agree with like both those points, like Josh, obviously with like policymakers kind of realizing the potential, you know, negative side effects of implementing like a full scale mechanism of payments where people can, the government can go in and track its citizens and what they're spending money on and stop them at their own discretion. And obviously with the second point is, you know, building applications that allow us to just mimic this economy that we have now, but in a more user-centric way. I want to piggyback off that. And so this final question that I had was, there seems to be this misconception, we've talked about it a little bit, but I want to address it, you know, head on here, that privacy, especially within cryptocurrencies and cryptocurrencies applications, is only used for illicit activity and only used for, you know, things that certain groups might deem as bad. So is the challenge in combating against that? Because, for example, if you had a privacy-centric application that was only in the eyes of, you know, said government only being used for bad things, which is if you listen to a lot of the recent commentary, that's how they view it, they'll sanction it and ban it and make it difficult to use. So how do you guys view the battle between not only working with users, but also working with, you know, regulators and different, you know, government officials and policymakers and ensuring them that these applications are actually, you know, doing better things for their citizens and enabling a more free economy that can create more economic opportunity for everyone in the world? What's the balance in creating applications if they're completely neutral and censorship resistant? That what's the balance in ensuring that those applications are built for more worthwhile use cases and ensuring that we have, you know, the position and the regulatory environment to continue building? How do you guys think of that from a narrative's perspective?
So one thing, I think there's a narrative war, right? So we see it, you know, coming from certain senators like Elizabeth Warren, some regulators, Treasury and so on, some regulators internationally that kind of cherry pick the data and, you know, try to create, and they work PR campaigns. So if you listen to them, they use the same language, right? And you can kind of spot the group of people that are all talking from the same sheet. But there's kind of a, you know, there's a question as to whether or not they're sincere in that, you know, calling that out as a potential risk, or if they're trying to get to something else. So like, I had a regulator tell me recently that they understand and believe, again, that crypto users, will need and demand privacy protections as it goes mainstream. And that's not their public kind of stance, but they recognize that that's true in order for it to work. But the problem is they don't want it to go mainstream, and they don't believe it will ever go mainstream. And that's what they're fighting against. And so they've got another agenda, and it has nothing to do with privacy. It has to do with crypto adoption. But these numbers that they throw out in the sheet of music that they all sing to, is intended for a different reason. And so sometimes the privacy stuff comes up, it's a red herring.
Our experience has been primarily, again, just more of a lack of education. We have several members of our team that go to DC regularly to engage and educate lawmakers, regulators, national defense members. And generally, after they better understand the tech, they haven't been necessarily anti-privacy. It's, if anything, they understand and appreciate that privacy is a critical component for this next generation of products and Web3. So to me, I think it's the onus is on us as an industry, as a community, to kind of educate people who don't necessarily have the same technical depth or perspective or exposure as probably most of the people in this Twitter space. And then it's also on us, I think, as an industry to kind of help monitor each other and really create, solve real-world use cases and ensure that this technology is not used, primarily for what some people would consider illicit transactions. And that's not the case right now, but I'm saying we need to do a job policing ourselves too.
I think the education can go so far, but there's a reality, even kind of at the highest reaches of the U.S. government and certainly with other governments that we've had conversations with, where there's still a desire to be able to have visibility at the government level. So recognizing that there's there's a need for privacy with cryptocurrencies. But I think I heard John, I think, articulate it once very well that, regulators have a job to do, right? And so they're going to want any tool at their disposal in order to be able to do that job. And to the extent that they have something like a backdoor through key escrow or some other mechanism for traceability, they're going to take every opportunity to get that. And they're going to try to apply pressure where they can to ensure that they have access.
Yeah, I think that's why we need to be on the side of consumers. We need to be on the side of users, because those are ultimately the constituents of our democracy. And, I think part of the reason why it's really easy to target things like coin mixers is that, individual citizens aren't going to stand up for coin mixers, because you're not going to be able to pull someone off the street and be like, hey, could you write a letter to your congressman about how your fundamental rights are, being violated? No one's going to do that. But if we believe that privacy enables more than just, and not to say this isn't a big deal, but more than just discretion, more than just hiding things, then we do have a shot, right? We do have a shot for individuals to say, these tools and these technologies are critical to my business and my well-being and my financial life. And if you take them away from me, that really gets in the way of me living my life as an American. And so I will write a letter to Congress to protest infringing on something that becomes a very important part of, our commercial fabric. So I think it's that's why I think everyone here would agree, like, we need privacy on the base layer, right? We need to have it by default, because anytime we have a small set of individuals electing privacy, it's really easy also for regulators to say, hey, look, most people don't care. It's only this tiny, tiny proportion of people who are going over there, and it happens to be that there are some illicit transactions, and so therefore, like, anyone who elects this specific privacy feature, they must be trying to hide something. Versus if if I go back to analogizing Ethereum, like, why didn't OFAC kind of ban Ethereum? Because there was some balance of harms. Like, obviously there's some illicit activity on Ethereum. Also, there's a bunch of really necessary and productive economic activity there. And so I think that's where we all need to get to if we want users and consumers to fight on our behalf.
And this is also where not just building privacy by default at the base layer, but why we have focused so hard on generalizable privacy, right? Private by default compute and generalizable applications, because it is a lot easier to get somebody to care about privacy for their own identity and reputation or something beyond just strictly financial assets. But it is harder because there's a lot of privacy projects in the space that don't build that way. They build specifically focused on financial transactions, and that's how regulators see it. And that's actually how most people just everywhere see crypto. They think Dogecoin is representative of crypto. It's just like an alternative to the US dollar, and it's got a weird cartoon character attached to it or something like that. That is a very common conception. And we're trying to break it more broadly by showing that truly useful applications that go beyond just strictly sending value from one place to another can be built and can be private by default and also decentralized. The more we can show that, just show that that's been built and that that can scale and that there's consumer demand for it, it starts to change the idea of like what privacy actually is. Because as long as we think it's just about hiding something from somebody else when it comes to moving money, that's one thing. But if we show that it's privacy for any type of data that we would want to be moving in a decentralized fashion, disintermediated, you know, where we're cutting out the middlemen and making it, again, more peer-to-peer, that's the conversation we want to be having, because that's where a lot more people are going to understand that there is something worth fighting for versus something where it's just not their problem. And you know, that takes all of us here working together, even though we're building, a lot of us, very different things. Even if you're not building for compute, it is important to fight that battle, because I think that's the battle we can win.
Yeah. To echo what Tor said, you know, I think that like the real, like one of the important things to make or narratives to push is that, you know, or I guess I think that like a lot of people in Web3 have viewed privacy through like a very narrow lens of like absolute anonymity for a long time. And really, hopefully we can move the needle a bit into, you know, showing that there's an entire spectrum of privacy that is possible with Web3 applications, and each use case has its own needs. And, you know, like, you know, for like social media, for gaming, for all these, you know, sort of applications, like privacy is needed in order to build sophisticated games and to build, you know, the next generation of Web3 that's going to be able to compete with Web2, but don't really have anything to do with anonymity, but still require confidential compute and the ability to have like not absolutely transparent blockchains. And so I think that that's like a key narrative that, that sort of needs to be pushed, as well as like, you know, things like social media, like things that are already regulated in traditional world that require privacy. And you can sort of say like, hey, if you're trying to get rid of privacy in Web2, there's like, it doesn't really make any sense because you require it. If you require privacy in Web2, but you don't allow us to have it in Web3, it doesn't make sense because we can't be regulatory compliant then. And so there's also the narrative of showing how privacy actually enables Web3 to be regulatory compliant, and perhaps even more so than what exists in Web2 today, in a way that, like, you know, protects users in to a higher degree and allows them more custody of their data and, you know, more security of that data as well, so it can't be leaked by centralized entities and this sort of thing. And so really understanding these points and communicating that to, you know, the next generation of Web3 users is going to be key into, you know, our goal is in the Universal Privacy Alliance of, you know, advocating for privacy.
No, yeah, completely agree. And I think all the points that were brought up here towards the end, like, all have, you know, like a very substantial amount of merit. And I think it's very evident that while we might have different approaches and might not agree on every single thing, we are united on this one front of making privacy more mainstream and making it more accessible to all these different, you know, applications and economies that we're all trying to build and be a part of. So we are over time. So I want to thank everybody who's made it this far and who's still listening with us. Really, really interesting conversation. Covered a lot of different things, from privacy narratives, the different applications that users might want and might want to see built, and also a little bit of discussion on how we can make this, you know, appealing and worthwhile to, you know, different regulators and different economies out there in the world. So if you want to hear more of these narratives and hear more about what the different organizations that are really focusing on driving Web3 privacy forward, I would highly recommend that you give this Twitter account a follow. And then we'll be putting out a lot of information over the next 3 to 4 days on the event that we're having at ETH Denver, which is the UPA Privacy Summit, where you can hear from all the organizations that have been up on stage today, and then also some other partner organizations. So we're going to be live streaming that event for people that can't make it to Denver. And if you are heading to Denver and haven't registered, we are at max capacity for the event. So the best way to access the content is via the live stream that's going to be here on Twitter and YouTube. So just again, want to thank all the speakers for coming up today and, you know, spending some time with us, and wonder if you guys have any closing thoughts.
Thanks a lot. It's been a privilege to be up here and talk with y'all.
Yeah, just want to say thank you for giving us this time and having such a great conversation. Please, all the audience, you know, make sure you follow the UPA Twitter page. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of privacy-related content coming from there, and can't wait to see it.
Awesome. Thanks, everyone. Have a great evening.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.